to go from here, and I worry about sort of sucking the oxygen out of the room after people had such hopes to moving the field forward. But in hindsight, when you look at it, we already have enough knowledge around herpes, and we already have enough tools that we should be doing more about that. The issue is, how do we mobilize stuff? And I thought the talk this morning about framing really sort of illustrates, I think, what we need to do, which is, how do we reframe all of this? And I'm not going to spend much time going through epi slides, but just to illustrate a couple of points. In terms of sheer prevalence in the U.S., I'm going to focus on U.S. populations, and in particular STD clinics and STD programs. General herpes due to HSV2 is the number one sexually transmitted infection. And if you look at cost, it's number three, only behind HIV and human papillomavirus. So it's hard to say that we shouldn't be paying attention to this on those two scales alone. Taking a look at the NHANES data, we've already talked about the disparities that exist, and I'm not going to go through all of this in any detail, but this is breaking down both men and women based on looking at white and black non-Hispanic males and females, lifetime number of sexual partners, same behavior in terms of number of lifetime partners, difference prevalence here. And this is an issue for those of us who are especially in the South, where we see a heterosexual epidemic as well as an MSM epidemic around HIV, that if you look at this, it's overwhelming to see that 2 to 4 lifetime partners among African American women results in a prevalence rate of genital herpes of around 50%. So this isn't really about individual behavior, it's about all the dynamics and contextual factors that lead to high prevalence rates, but really it comes back to, why should we care and make a diagnosis? It is an ongoing epidemic. We know about neonatal herpes, and that's not the focus of this brief summary, but really I just want to spend a little bit of time on the last two points here. One, we know that HSV transmission occurs in settings of undiagnosed and unrecognized genital herpes infection. That's, you get herpes from someone else who has herpes. It's interesting that we've taken HIV and said you get HIV from folks who have HIV, therefore we need to identify all those individuals so we can intervene and focus our intervention. And I understand that the prevalence for herpes is much greater, but it's the same concept. If we're really going to have an impact on changing transmission, that requires identifying folks with herpes. And the sheer nature, natural history of genital herpes, that transmission is not linked to symptoms, signs, means that you have to do testing to find these folks, not have them walk into our clinics with genital ulcers. But I think there's more of a challenge to that, as Sue will get to, and that we don't have enough resources. So I'm hoping I can move us to an understanding that we're going to have to actually pick, with a little bit of help, what our key targets are and how far down the list we need to be able to go based on our resources to identify places or folks or individuals that we should be doing screening and intervention with treatment. Connie alluded to the fact that we see an overlap of epidemics. So if we look at HIV and HSV, those individuals that are HIV infected, 60 to 70% of them actually have genital herpes infection, yet only about 20% of those individuals actually are aware that they're infected. So the idea that 90%+ of individuals in the general population have herpes and are unaware of it is also true for people with HIV, even though many of these folks are in care. And if you look at co-infection rates, it varies a great deal. And again, focusing on women and African Americans, we're looking at co-infection rates for those that are HIV infected. Up to 80% also have HSV2 infection. And to translate that, and that's the issue here, how do we move this understanding of herpes and say, what are we trying to prevent? I mean, I think it's worthwhile to say we should be preventing disease and deal with the consequences of it, but what we're trying to prevent here in terms of the greater scope and cost, neonatal herpes, and in this talk, HIV infection, if we look at population attributable risk in the U.S., we're finding somewhere between 20% and 35% of new HIV infections are attributable to prior HSV2 infections. So what about Connie's data and what does it mean? Well, we didn't abandon bacterial STI control after RAKI. We've had 4 randomized controlled trials for interventions around STDs to look at HIV acquisition. Only one of them, Mwanza, showed a benefit. 3 subsequent ones did not, and yet we haven't stopped treating gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis because we don't think it has any impact on HIV. So I think we have to sort of step back and realize that the data from the trial is the data from the trial, are the data from the trial, and that is acyclovir suppression did not show a benefit in reducing HIV acquisition in folks that had HSV2. That's the extent of it, and there are a lot of things that we hope to learn from that. Secondly, HSV control is important for all the things that I just talked about, but frankly, it's non-existent. You don't hear about very many programs having an HSV control program or someone who's in charge of their HSV control at the state and local level. Prevention at this point is largely dependent on diagnosis, and I think the data on HIV acquisition in this study really causes one to pause about where we can go with behavioral interventions around condom use in high prevalence settings for HSV2 and HIV. That I'm certainly an advocate for condom use and behavior change, but it's not an adequate tool alone, so we need to look at additive or synergistic effects of multiple ways of intervening. So prevention really, in this case, for those with HSV can be focused on reducing HSV transmission, and for those that are diagnosed having HSV2, taking steps to raise their awareness so that they can take steps to reduce their risk of acquiring or transmitting HIV in the case of dual transmission. Now, what is the prevalence of HSV2 infection? It's here, but notice in STD clinics. John likes to talk about low-hanging fruit. We have it in our STD clinics. Depending on your site in the country, it's going to vary a little bit in the lower or higher end, but about 40 to 60% of folks attending STD clinics have infection due to HSV2, yet very few programs offer universal screening. So let's go back and look at the recommendations out of the 2006 STD treatment guidelines. All patients who have genital ulcers should be evaluated with a serologic test for syphilis and a diagnostic test for evaluation of genital herpes. That includes specific tests such as syphilis serology, dark field examination, culture for herpes or PCR test, and culture for H. decreyi. Both virologic and type-specific serologic tests for HSV should be available in clinical settings that provide care. Now note, that second statement isn't for people just with genital ulcer disease. That second statement is a consensus statement that we came to in the 2006 guidelines that for patients seeking STD care, we should be offering HSV serologic testing. So I already think we have consensus. The idea that we don't know who we should be doing this in, we already have consensus on certain populations. So if we want to look at where we need to go next, it's expanding testing within STD clinics and realizing the limitations there. How do we figure out and whom to offer it in that setting? So it's easy to talk about, you just make the diagnosis by looking at the ulcer, but the truth is that the classic description of genital herpes, of vesicles and ulcerations, isn't the way it commonly presents. So we need to go beyond tools that just look at swab tests for genital lesions. If we look at the etiology of genital ulcers, we do see that about 60% are due to herpes in 10 of 11 U.S. cities with high syphilis rates. So this is skewed towards where you're going to find other etiologies. If you step out of the pockets of syphilis, you're actually going to find even a higher percentage of genital ulcer cases in STD clinics due to genital herpes. The evaluations I'm not going to spend time to, but certainly a part of this evaluation that's necessary for genital ulcers includes type-specific tests. They're there, they're available. But if you step back and you look at what state and public health laboratories provide, in a survey that was from 2004 but published in 2007, I'll just draw you down to here. For type-specific tests, only 6% of the labs that were surveyed offer type-specific tests. That amounted to 13,000 tests. That's it. If we look at data from FOCUS, looking at the Herpes Select Serologic Test, the number of tests performed nationally was about 2.5 million. The total number sold to public health, 25,000. So are we missing the mark? We're missing it. We're not even close. We're missing it by a grand scheme. So I understand that people say, well, are we saying we should be screening everyone? That's a whole other debate for another topic. For a focused group that we already said through consensus should be offered serologic screening, we're not coming close. So what are the arguments concerning serologic screening? Well, they boil down to time, cost, and the psychological ramifications of testing. The time really can be minimized, and it's a crucial part of operationalizing screening and testing. We have to have better tools. I know that there's a plan to actually redo the toolkit, having scripts or algorithms that are easily available either directly through pamphlets or on the web for clinicians will really be important to shorten the amount of time that it takes to actually move people through. The diagnosis, in my mind, is no more complicated than that we have for HIV and syphilis. The issue is the volume of number of positives that we identify. Now, I'm not knocking the people who presented the poster here looking at the consequences of diagnosis, but I've listed about six studies down at the bottom of this slide that all state that there's a minimal psychological impact on giving someone a serologic diagnosis of genital herpes. And so the question I have really is the psychological impact, and I'll jump down to that, is certainly there, but with proper training, and it doesn't take much, and framing the discussion, it's minimal. Most of that impact that I've seen anecdotally from the patients that I take care of, people walk in with severe genital ulcer disease, not from folks who we've screened, if we prepare them properly and come up with a positive test. So revising the toolkit is important, but I think we have to address the staff. And the attitude that, and the impact that I think happens with our patients and clients is frequently, I think, driven by the attitude the staff has in providing the diagnosis. So destigmatizing, making people feel more comfortable providing that information, giving them the idea of what are the two or three things they should be communicating, will go a long way to making this a much more streamlined process. Ned talked about cost and the cost impact, and I think what we'll hear frequently is that the tests are expensive. They're not that expensive, but we don't have additional money. So I think we have to really develop selected screening, which I know people don't want to hear the word target, but in essence, we've done that before for programs that we've rolled out. Chlamydia screening is a great example. We didn't have funds through IPP to screen all women. So we looked at the prevalence and where we had the greatest impact, and we decided to roll out screening for that group. I didn't hear much pushback that we shouldn't be doing it until we can offer it to everyone. And I understand equity, I understand social justice, but I also realize the limitation of funds and time. Secondly, we need to couch cost into cost savings in terms of return visits for recurrent genital symptoms or ulcers, misdiagnosis, and downstream transmission of both HSV and HIV and the impact that that has on our public health infrastructure. And then finally, I think we do need help in setting these priorities and figuring out where to go from a program science standpoint. Where's the greatest impact once we decide what impact we want as an outcome? So the case for serologic screening in STD clinics. We continue to do almost nothing for the most prevalent STI and a third most costly STI in the U.S. Our approach to testing for testing only genital ulcer diseases missed the majority of individuals who come into our clinics with genital herpes. Since even if you say, well, how often or how many days a year would someone with four recurrences or three recurrences a year would have lesions, it's only about 12 to 15 days a year. So if we're going to test our way out of this, it's not going to be through doing genital ulcer diagnosis. We already collect risk factors and sexual history in our STD clinics, which would allow us to develop, I think, a pretty simple selective screen criteria. The screening needs to be based on outcomes. What are we trying to prevent? HIV risk or acquisition, transmission of both HIV and HSV, peak incidence populations. I'm going to finish up with that in a second. And then consideration must be also given to overall prevalence in our local populations. The performance of the type-specific assays are good, but if you're looking at low prevalence populations, we do have problems with positive predictive values. So we can have a rough idea of what clinics or settings make sense to offer screening based on population-based evidence for prevalence. The majority of STD clients want or expect to be tested, so we really do need to deliver the goods here. And because in our STD clinics we do have high prevalence, I think we're talking a game in terms of problems of false positives that really isn't true for the majority of our STD clinics. So a starting point. Well, current CDC recommendations, as I've mentioned, already are what are consensus, and you can read this. The bottom line here is for those who present for a comprehensive STD evaluation. What are four low-cost steps then for reducing the risk of transmission of HSV? These are things we can do right now. Telling someone, which seems like the duh factor, but to avoid sexual contact during outbreaks, but because people don't recognize their outbreaks, unless you're giving them a diagnosis and giving them the brief tool to recognize it, they can't avoid having sex when they have genital fissuring or lesions that last for a couple of days. Disclosure to sexual partners. low cost in terms of money, you might argue high cost in terms of stress, but it can be done. It can be done effectively without a whole lot of time spent educating patients on how to do this. And I see Dennis is in the second row. I think we've got the tools to be able to do it. Condom use, and then antiviral suppressive therapy. The latter, I would argue, could be used in terms of incidence or newly diagnosed patients. If we had to say, and whom do we want to target? Well, we know that the shedding rates for herpes are greatest in the first 6 months. Therefore, the transmission is going to be greatest during the first 6 months or a year after acquisition. The risk for HIV is also greatest in this group, whether we're looking at STD clinic populations or MSM. Those with recent incidents have the highest risk for acquisition of HIV. And if we look at population benefits in terms of suppression, the greatest benefit, and this is taken from two different studies here, is looking at suppressing individuals with incident infection. So if I had to ask, where can we supply suppressive therapy? I think we should be going for incident HSV cases to concentrate on reducing transmission of HSV and reducing HIV acquisition. And I understand there's costs involved with that, but the cost is relatively cheap. Knowing that acyclovir suppression has, at this point, no impact on HIV acquisition, but in terms of controlling HSV transmission, we can do it, and we are doing it in North Carolina, for a little under $10 for 4 months suppression. The state provides that now for all newly diagnosed patients in our STD clinics in North Carolina. We're not breaking the bank with that. So, in summary, HSV intervention, to steal a line from Obama, so we have full disclosure, yes, we can.